Welcome to Opus. I'm Gretchen Gondek. Today's episode is a collaboration with Siouxland Arts Live, a project that puts focus on the music and culture of Siouxland. It is made possible by a grant from the M.A. Martin Everest Foundation. Pianist Boris Slutsky burst onto the scene in 1981, winning every major prize at the William Capel International Piano Competition. Since then, he has performed around the world, playing in chamber groups and with major symphonies. But his passion has been teaching. He is chair of piano at the Peabody Conservatory and has recently begun teaching at Northwestern University as well. When he was in Sioux City for the Morningside Piano Recital Series, we sat down at one of the pianos in the office of Professor James March at Morningside College, where Boris opened up about his life and the music he loves. We began the conversation talking about his youth in Russia.
Well, I was born in Moscow. Actually, just a couple weeks ago, it was a 40th anniversary of my arrival to this country. So my family immigrated in 1977, 18th of October to be exact. We arrived in New York. I was very fortunate. I was studying at one of the best, if not the best, schools ever imaginable. It was the Gnesin music school. We had all of our disciplines combined, music and all the other disciplines were all in the same school. So there was a lot of time devoted to practicing, to studying. Everyone had two lessons a week, which is, I think, the way it should be for younger kids. And I loved it. I loved the school. I loved my teacher, and I still keep up with her, so keep in touch.
What are some of your earliest musical memories growing up in a family that was highly musical?
Both my parents played string instruments, violin and viola. My grandmother was a pianist. So music was a part of my life since basically I was born. And I heard my father's violin students coming to the house and playing, and I heard my parents practicing, so there are a whole bunch of memories associated with music. And I started myself at the age of 7, which is now considered rather late. I'm not sure if my parents really wanted me to be a musician at the beginning, but I think they were very happy to push me into this.
And talk a little bit about your training with Anna Cantor.
Well, she's the one of the two most influential people in my life, I could say, without a doubt. Of course, she became very well known because she was also a teacher, the only teacher of Yevgeny Kisin. And I owe her a huge debt of gratitude. She basically... I owe to her in large part what I am today. She taught me so many things. She taught me creativity, responsibility, just basic musical training. I owe it all to her.
Could you articulate for our listeners the difference between the approach to Russian musical education versus the American system of musical education?
Well, I'll try. At the time that I was in school in Russia, it was incredibly difficult to get into those special schools. There was a huge competition to get into the school, and then every couple of years there was a huge competition to stay in school. Those who did not perform well in their exams were either asked to leave the school or switch to another instrument where there was a deficit. For instance, we didn't have enough bassoons, and those who exhibited musical talent but not proficiency at piano, for instance, were often asked to switch to bassoon or oboe, if whatever the instrument, which was considered to be easier in terms of technical set than piano. The school as I said, was very competitive. There were lots of performance opportunities. We were all playing concerts, sometimes on TV, sometimes in various halls. Unfortunately, there's no such thing in this country. Perhaps places like Interlaken and Idlewild and such come close, but there are very few of them. So that's other than that, I don't think there's a centralized system in this country, and there was a very strong centralized system of education in Russia. So basically, people at a certain level were all expected to know their theory and their music history and solfège.
You made your orchestral debut in Carnegie Hall with the New York Youth Symphony in 1980, and since then you have appeared on nearly every continent as soloist and recitalist. And in reading about you, Boris, there's a lot of commentary on, there's a very Russian flavor to your performances in the pieces that you're playing. Are you aware of that? I mean, when you're playing it, is it conscious? Is it just part of how you perform?
I'm not sure what you mean by Russian flavor. I am Russian trained. Most of my teachers in this country, and I'd like to mention a few of them, Alexander Edelman was also a huge influence on me. He was a man who came to this country when he was 75 years old. He was classmates with Vladimir Horowitz in Kiev in early 20th century. Then he was a lifelong friend and colleague and student of Henrik Neuhaus, who was a huge figure in Russian pedagogical world. Nadia Reisenberg, who I studied with in New York when I first came, was a student of Hoffman and Nikolaev and Lambert. So the roots go. If I had to trace all the roots from all my teachers, it would be very confusing, but very exciting at the same time. I also studied with John Browning, who was a student of Rosina Levine and Joseph Levine. So my teachers, most of them anyway, had roots in the Russian tradition. Perhaps that's what you call Russian flavor. Its emphasis, with my very early training, there was always emphasis on sound, on the beauty of the sound, and nothing was allowed to be performed without some sense of color and imagination, at least by my teachers.
Well, this is very inspiring to hear about this. This legacy being passed from teacher to student, and now my thought is that is exactly what you are doing with your students.
I've always said that if I'm able to give even a fraction of what my teachers gave to me, if I'm able to pass that on to my students, I would be delighted. It's an incredibly rewarding work. To work with young people and to see their eyes lit up when they discover something for themselves and begin to experience this incredible world of music, color, sound, creativity.
Last evening you performed a recital as part of the Morningside College Piano Recital Series. Would you like to talk about that and kind of your thought with the program and the pieces that you selected and performed?
Well, these are some of my favorite pieces that I've performed quite a bit. It just so happened that this program was probably the most accessible at the moment. At first I had other ideas about programming different pieces, but I settled on those pieces, and I think they work really well together, and they provide a lot of contrast and diversity.
Can we hear something from the recital?
Sure. I'll start with the last piece I performed, the encore, which is Chopin Etude, Opus 25, number 7, also known as the cello etude.
Thank you.
We've been listening to Boris Slutsky performing a Chopin etude known as the cello etude. That was lovely.
Thank you.
And that was your encore.
That was my encore last night.
From last night. Why is it subtitled the cello etude?
Because the main melodic material is written in the register of a cello, and that nickname was not, I think, given by Chopin. It was just perhaps publishers, or because it does so much remind us of the cello sound.
You finished your formal studies in music at Juilliard and the Manhattan School of Music. How did you come to be on the faculty of Peabody Conservatory?
Chance. I always dreamed of working at Peabody Conservatory, and I had many friends who were teaching there, and there was a situation where more students were accepted than there was room for with the current faculty at the time. So there was a search to find someone to teach those extra students for a period of 1 to 2 years, and so I was chosen. And it just evolved from there, because as soon as I got to Peabody, one of the faculty members decided to retire. And so there was an open position, and I eventually took over that open position. That was 25 years ago.
Oh, my. And you were actually chair of the piano department?
I was chair for two different periods. The most recent one was 8 years long, and I stepped down as being chair this academic year. So I'm no longer chair, thankfully.
That is a lot of responsibility.
It was a lot of work, yes.
So you're directly involved in planning curriculum?
Not directly involved. I served on various committees. Curriculum was one of them, where we discuss. I mean, there's not a huge, change that's possible within the confines of a college education. There are several required courses that everyone has to take in liberal arts and in music theory, harmony, and whatnot. In addition, Peabody is doing something somewhat unique, although every other school is going in that direction at the moment, trying to figure out what it takes to educate a 21st century musician, because it's very different these days. The job market, so to say, is very crowded. The interest in classical music is sort of diminishing, at least in this country. For instance, in China, by various accounts, there are between 10 million and 30 million piano students, just piano students, which is enormous number. And at least somewhere in the world, people are still playing instruments and are being interested in pursuing studies in music.
Well, you raise an interesting point, Boris, about classical music, and I have very strong feelings about that in my position at the public radio station here for many years. Classical was my thing, and I thought it was very important, not just to provide that for our listeners, but to inspire children to the importance of classical music. And all the studies that reflect classical music is very important to a young child's brain.
Undoubtedly. So there have been many studies, especially some that came out recently, linking music studies to excellence in other academic fields. It teaches so many different things. It teaches creativity, it teaches abstract thinking, it teaches discipline, for most important, perhaps, of those things. And it baffles me that the first things that usually get cut are music and arts-related things. And that's what I always remember a quote by Winston Churchill when someone asked him during the Second World War to cut funding for music and art. And his response was, in that case, what are we fighting for? So I think it's extremely important for future generations to have the kids, the young children and young adults, to have them and to give them an opportunity to be exposed to beautiful things in life, to music, to art. I think that the whole society would benefit from it.
How many students do you currently have at Peabody?
It's always a fluctuating number. On paper, I have 16. In reality, I have more because some of them are no longer registered for lesson, but are still in the doctoral program, and they still have competitions, and they still have recitals, and they still come and play for me. But the number is 16.
We talked a little bit earlier about your approach and strategy to working with students. Could we dig a little deeper into your philosophies about teaching?
Sure. It's interesting that you asked me that question. My teacher, Anna Cantor, who lived in New York for quite a while, was very available to come and give classes. And I've asked her a million times to come and give a class at Peabody for the students. And she kept refusing. And finally, I said, but why? You know, you taught me so much. Why would you not do this? Why would you not agree? I will translate. She did not speak English, obviously. And she said, well, in order to be a successful masterclass teacher, you have to have a method. And she said, I don't have a method. I look at each student individually, and I react to each student's needs. And what I say to one student may not be relevant to another. So that always impressed me, because I think that's very important, not to create formulas for passing to every single person, but to really look at each one individually to discover what their greatest strengths are, and to try and encourage them and to work on weaknesses. So I guess that's what I try to do most importantly, and to not necessarily explain every little thing to them. I do a lot of explaining, and I work a lot on details, but to allow them to discover things, maybe perhaps lead them to discover things on their own, because those things are the most valuable when they have the self-worth that they've actually achieved something and discovered something on their own. I work a lot on sound production, because as I said, that's how I was taught. Sound was very important. And I work a lot on basically just developing their own individual voice, because we all have different voices, and each pianist can make the set, you know. Sometimes we wonder, was that the same piano that we just heard? And yes, it was, but just a different person playing it. So we all have different things that we hear, and I think it's very valuable that each student develop their own personal voice and personal approach while developing their technical skills and the ability to solve issues and to produce the sound that would be beautiful but different.
When you talked about the 21st century being a more challenging time for pianists and musicians and artists in general, how do you prepare a student to face those challenges? I mean, obviously, there aren't as many opportunities in a performing concert career. How do you prepare them for that?
Oh, this probably books could be written to answer that question. It's very challenging. It's very difficult. At the time that I was in school, things were in a way much easier, because the markets were not as flooded with excellent pianist musicians as they are now. So teaching jobs were they were still very difficult to get, but they were a lot more accessible than they are now. So how do we prepare them? Well, when people ask me if they should continue pursuing music, my answer is always the same, if only if you can't live without it, because there are so many more lucrative fields. And if unless you really can't live without making music your livelihood, your profession, I don't think one should pursue it. But for those who really are passionate about making a life in music, there are numerous possibilities. You're right, the concert venues are diminishing. It was an interesting story. I heard that András Schiff came to talk to students at the Eastman School of Music, and the same question was posed to him. How does one get ahead? And he, I hope it was a joke, he said, well, actually, you know, it's just the middle is crowded. There's plenty of room at the top. But the middle, those people who are not going to become huge stars, which is also in many cases a matter of luck, they should be versatile. For pianists, for instance, for other instruments, for strings, for instance, they can do freelancing, play with different ensembles, different orchestras, until they find something permanent. For pianists, there are seemingly less opportunities, but on the other hand, there's nothing that can happen without a piano. A singer can't sing without an accompanist, without a collaborator on the piano, in most cases. So I encourage my students to look at all kinds of music, different music. You never know what opportunities may come in the future. To be able to play with an instrumentalist, to be able to play chamber music well, which is, by the way, my passion, chamber music. If I had to choose my favorite musical activity, that would be it. To be well-versed in the language of today's music, the music that's being written today, not all of which is good, but there's enough good music that's worth championing and discovering. So all of those things. And I tell them the truth. It's not easy. It's not an easy path.
Boris, I wonder if we might have a little more music, something from your recital at Morningside College.
Sure. I'll play the first movement of the Haydn Sonata that I did yesterday. Thank you.
We've been listening to Boris Lutsky at the piano performing the very spirited Allegro from Franz Joseph Haydn's Sonata in G Major, Hoboken 16, number 6. That's just what I needed this morning to kind of perk me up. That was wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you.
You talked about chamber music as your favorite form of expression when you're performing. What particular challenges are there with a chamber ensemble?
There are some challenges because you're not the only one playing, so you have to really listen to what your chamber music partners have to say and try to make music together, not by yourself. So that is slightly different than playing solo, where you can do whatever you want. I've been extremely fortunate to have played with some of the, I think, world's best musicians. And it's interesting that for the most part, when we rehearse, we don't talk. It is so clear how we are able to respond to one another without really having to discuss. I've been in situations where discussions would begin before the first note was played, how the phrase should go and what tempo needs to take place at any given moment. So that was always a little foreign to me. And again, as I said, I've been extremely lucky to play with amazing musicians, and it's just the most, I think, rewarding to make music together and to blend as one, keeping our own individual voices.
It seems to me there be a very particular kind of chemistry and balance when you're performing in a small ensemble like that.
It's always important. It's always important.
You have done some recording on the Naxos label.
It was quite a while ago. I recorded Schumann sonatas with a fantastic violinist by the name of Ilya Kahler. And we had a duo for a number of years, and we traveled to many countries in Asia, South Africa, played a lot in this country. And then we both got very busy with other things, with teaching in my case, and his case as well. And he has quite a big career playing, performing solo. So that's with whom I recorded the Schumann sonatas. It was wonderful, wonderful experience.
Would you like to do more recordings?
I'm very self-conscious about every little imperfection that happens during performance. And I always felt that the studio recordings cannot really compare to live recordings in their... there's always something clinical about doing a studio recording. So someone like Arthur Rubinstein, for instance, hated studio recordings. And his live performances, no matter how imperfect, have always been incredibly inspiring, where the studio recordings, as beautiful as they were, could not really reach the same level. But I'm very self-conscious. So yes, I would like to do some more recording. I just haven't gotten around to it. That's the short answer.
Let's talk about your performing career. You have played virtually every continent. Do you have a number of engagements this fall or into next year?
I am traveling to Russia in April to be a part of the Neuhaus Festival and Competition, where I will perform in a concert in Moscow. Before that, I have a Mozart concerto, K-467, also known as Elvira Madigan Concerto, that I'm performing with a fantastic, fabulous conductor, Andrew Constantine, in Pennsylvania, Reading, Pennsylvania. And then I have some more engagements in the summertime. So not with my current teaching schedule, it's not so easy to find time to perform.
Is it exciting to travel, or do you find it wearing?
It's getting to be a little bit wearing on me. I still love traveling, and I love interacting with musicians in different places. It's getting a little tired. I've had situations where I would have to travel to Asia and play the next day. And I didn't think much of it back then. Now it's getting a little more difficult.
What other music intrigues you, Boris, that's non-classical?
All music intrigues me. Jazz intrigues me. I'm not a huge fan of rap music. I'm not a huge fan of the music scene, for the most part, that I hear on the radio today. It just lacks creativity. There are three harmonies, or four harmonies at the most, with different variants. So, to tell you the truth, I hear so much music that sometimes an hour of quiet time really is very well appreciated.
What else do you like to do in the extracurricular realm of life?
There's not too much time in that realm, but I love traveling. Spain is the country, my preferred country to travel. I love Spain. I love the music. I love the food. I like the scenery.
If you have a favorite artist, you mentioned Spain, visual artist, who would that be?
Well, so many. Dalí, Picasso, Miró. Really many. The old masters, Velázquez, if we're talking about Spain. But there are, art is art. There are so many different great artists that existed and still live today.
Do you do any Russian cooking?
Of course.
What's your signature dish?
Well, it's southern, right? It's Caucasian, Georgian. My signature dish has always been a leg of lamb or a rack of lamb.
I love lamb.
Well, you should visit.
Well, let's continue with some music, Boris. I would love to hear some Ravel.
This is Oiseau Triste from the set called Miroir.
Thank you.
We've been listening to Boris Slutsky performing L'Oiseau Triste from Ravel's Miroir. I find that so interesting, the L'Oiseau Triste contrasted with the next piece that you performed on the recital last evening, the Alboreto del Gracioso.
Yes, I mean, the whole set is wonderful, and I would like to perform that as a set next time. Each piece is so descriptive and just paints, really, if you think of notes as colors, the Ravel paints pictures with his music. In the third piece, which is called in English, The Boat in the Ocean, you can really hear the water, you can really see the reflections of the water. It's quite amazing.
Well, oiseau is French for bird.
Yes.
And I could hear some fluttering, feathers fluttering in there.
The translation of the oiseau triste is sad birds, so very descriptive title.
It was lovely. And Boris, this has been a most lovely hour for me and very inspirational. And I want to thank you for your time, your insight, your artistry, and your great talent, sharing that on Siouxland Public Media today. We've made many demands on your energy and time today, so please know how very grateful we are for this hour with you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really wonderful to be here.
Thank you, and all the best.
Thank you.
Do come back soon.
I would love to. Thank you.
We would like to thank Morningside College Professor Dr. James March for allowing us to record that interview and performance with Boris Slutsky, and the M.A. Martin Everest Foundation for supporting Siouxland Arts Live. I'm Gretchen Gondek, and this is Opus. Slutsky mentioned his love of chamber music in our interview, so we thought we'd play his recording with Ilya Kaler of Schumann's Violin Sonata No. 1 in A Minor, Opus 105, Numbers 1 and 2. Thank you. Schumann's Violin Sonata No. 1 in A Minor, Opus 105, Numbers 1 and 2, performed by our guest this hour, Boris Slutsky, and violinist Ilya Kaler, released in 1994 on the Naxos label. We will close this hour with another selection from Ravel's Miroir. This is the third piece from that collection, inspired by the sea Un Barque sur l'Océan, featuring Pascal Roget.
Thank you.